Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Richard Jackson, President and Founder of the Global Aging Institute, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman will join the show to discuss the third issue brief in our series titled The Shape of Things to Come, as well as developments on COVID-19 relief legislation and fiscal year 2021 appropriations. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that after months of negotiating, Congress cleared a mammoth spending package that would provide nearly $900 billion in coronavirus aid and fund all federal agencies through next September. As soon as the 5,593 pages of legislative text could be printed and assembled, congressional leaders raced to ram it through both chambers before heading home for the holiday break. Lawmakers had only hours to review the final text before voting on pandemic relief and $1.4 trillion in long-delayed regular appropriations for fiscal year 2021, which began October 1st. The White House has indicated that President Trump would sign it, but both chambers also passed a one-week stopgap funding measure to avoid the risk of any government shutdown over Christmas while all the paperwork for the omnibus was prepared for the president's signature. The pandemic relief measure would deliver the first major infusion of new aid in 9 months since Congress passed a roughly $2 trillion package in March. It would provide new money for small business loans, $300 expanded unemployment benefits for 10 weeks, a new round of $600 tax rebate checks, billions of dollars for vaccine distribution, and many other provisions. Up next, Richard Jackson, president of the Global Aging Institute, and Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby, will join me to discuss the third issue brief in our Shape of Things to Come series, titled, Are Health Spans Rising Along with Lifespans? We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Richard Jackson. Bob is the Concord Coalition's executive director and a regular contributor on the show. Richard is the president and founder of the Global Aging Institute. GAI is an internationally recognized authority on global aging. Prior to launching GAI, Richard directed a research program on global aging at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's the author or co-author of numerous policy studies on the global aging challenge, regularly speaks on aging-related issues, and is widely quoted in the media. He holds a PhD in history from Yale. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob and Richard.
Thank you, Chase.
Pleasure to be here.
Happy to have you both here. We're discussing the third paper in a series called The Shape of Things to Come, which is a joint effort by GAI and the Concord Coalition. The third paper is titled, Are Health Spans Rising Along with Lifespans? And I'm going to kick it right over to you, Richard. And just for the benefit of our listeners, maybe do a quick explanation on the premise of the paper and maybe the high-level conclusions you made at the end.
Yeah, sure, Chase. Look, there are a lot of things that demographers and economists can tell us about the impact of the aging of the population on the budget, on the economy, on the society, with a relative degree of certainty. But there are also a few big questions that are subject to considerable debate. I mean, one, for instance, is what happens to savings and investment. Both are likely to fall as society ages, but which falls more will determine whether we're headed towards a long-term future of capital surpluses or capital shortages. So which one is it? Well, we don't know yet. Another is the impact of aging on social mood. Now, there's large literature in the behavioral and social sciences that confirms what's intuitively obvious. As individuals, most of us tend to become more risk-averse, and our time horizons tend to grow shorter as we grow older. But what about society as a whole as it ages? We don't know. Then, perhaps the most consequential up in the air question of all. Are health spans rising along with lifespans? Chase, you're not nearly old enough to remember the 50s game show. Bob, you and I maybe, but you probably heard of the $64,000 question, right? Well, are health spans likely to rise along with lifespans in aging societies is the $64 trillion question, right? Why? Well, because whether they do or not will have a big influence on our ability to accomplish two other things that most demographers and economists and policy experts would agree we need to do as society ages. And the first is to extend work lives. Obviously, the ability to work depends to some significant extent on health status. Better health at older ages means that more older workers will be able to remain employed. Better health at older ages also means that older workers, that output for each older worker who does remain employed is likely to rise because healthier workers are more productive workers. Right. Together with rising life expectancy, rising health expectancy also increases incentives to invest in human capital. And this should increase the productivity of workers at all ages. The second thing we know we need to do is to control healthcare spending. And the elderly are disproportionate consumers of healthcare. I mean, let's face it. Healthcare is the potentially most explosive dimension of old age dependency. In the United States, the elderly spend per capita or consume per capita about three times as much in acute care services as the non-elderly and about 20 times as much in long-term care services. The elderly, moreover, are the fastest growing segment of the population. The older the elderly are, the more healthcare they consume. And the oldest elderly age brackets are the fastest growing of all. So what's going to happen? Will health spans rise along with lifespans? Will they facilitate what's sometimes called productive aging? Will they help control healthcare costs? I think the answer to the first is a cautious yes, hopefully, possibly, maybe even probably. To the second, on healthcare costs, I'm skeptical, and I'd be happy to talk about why.
That was a lot of hedging there, Richard, on the conclusions. A very, very
uncharacteristic hedging, huh?
Well, I'm curious. I'm sure Bob and I have a number of follow-up questions, but on the cautious yes for health spans improving with lifespans, what's the reason for that? You know, what could be causing health spans to improve? Is it because we spend so much on healthcare and we're, you know, pumping that money into ensuring that people can live longer and perhaps live a healthier lifestyle, or is it a community health-based issue? What are some of the big factors there that influence your conclusion?
Look, experts have long debated this question of the relationship between aging and health, between lifespans and health spans. And it's a little bit more complicated than this, but essentially there are two competing models of aging and health. One school of thought, these are the optimists, subscribe to what's usually called the compression of morbidity thesis. And what the compression of morbidity thesis postulates is that health expectancy will rise at least as fast or indeed faster than life expectancy until most of the ills of old age are compressed, right, or relegated to some relatively brief span of time immediately before death. So we all live to 105 and die of a cold, right, in the extreme formulation. The competing model subscribes to what is sometimes called the failure of success theoretical framework. And what the failure of success framework holds is that most of what modern medicine does it's not to restore us to full health, right? It's keeping us from dying, but to use sort of the brutal clinical technical terminology, it's increasing the number of marginal survivors in the population. So as lifespans rise, we should actually see rising rates of age-specific chronic morbidity and disability. So that's the pessimistic take. Now, the final jury is still out. But I think, and this makes the story more interesting, right? Everybody likes a good news, bad news story. I think that the tentative evidence suggests that both schools of thought are at least partially right, okay? So the good news is that rates of disability are falling. The classic study in the United States, which came out about 15 years ago, concluded that rates of disability among the elderly from the early 80s through about the middle of the middle of the 2000 decade declined by about 25%. Right? That's a very big improvement in disability rates. Data from the World Health Organization suggests that healthy life expectancy across most developed countries, healthy life expectancy as measured by years of life remaining free from disability, since 1990 has risen by about 4 to 5 years, more in each country than the gain in total life expectancy. So it would seem that a compression of morbidity is underway. But there's always a but in my presentations. There are three big caveats. The first caveat is that past trends in disability are not necessarily the best predictor of future trends in disability. I mean, think about it this way. If you want to know what the health of a 75-year-old is going to be 30 years from now, or across the population, right? What's the average health of 75-year-olds going to be? Well, do you look at the health of 75-year-olds today, or do you look at the health of 45-year-olds today? The right answer is 45-year-olds. And here the trends are worrisome. There's the obesity epidemic compounded by substance abuse and other poor lifestyle choices among midlife adults. A growing share of the U.S. population in midlife is at risk of premature morbidity and death. If these trends continue, the recent declines in elderly disability, right, when these midlife adults become tomorrow's elderly, could reverse. And indeed, there's some recent evidence that elderly disability rates in the U.S. are no longer declining, and in fact, may be beginning to rise again. So that's number one, caveat one. Caveat two, disability isn't the same thing as morbidity. Disability is measured by limitations on what are called activities of daily living, like being able to get dressed on your own or being able to bathe yourself, or instrumental activities of daily living, like being able to go shopping or being able to manage your money balance, your checkbook. It's entirely possible that disability, that measured disability, could be declining among the elderly, right? Underlying illness is flatter rising. And indeed, this is what seems to be happening. If you look at chronic morbidity, if you look at high rates of hypertension, heart disease, diabetes, these are flat or rising. in the United States and in most other developed countries, even as measured disability is falling. So if you think about this, maybe it's not a compression of morbidity that we're witnessing, it's a compression of disability. And this has really important implications for healthcare costs. It seems intuitively obvious that less disability should mean lower healthcare spending. But maybe the optimists have it precisely backwards. Maybe it's the fact that we're spending so much per capita on healthcare that's the very reason the elderly are becoming less disabled, right? In other words, grandma's getting around better, but she's getting around better because she's seeing her doctor, right, and taking her pills as often or more often than before. Finally, third caveat, there are other things going on. Health status is not the only driver of healthcare spending, right? And in fact, if falling disability rates among the elderly could be expected to lower future healthcare spending beneath current projections, then we should have expected them to lower past spending too, because this falling disability trend has been going on for the past 25, 30, 35 years. Yet healthcare spending has continued to rise rapidly in the United States and most developed countries. There are other drivers. There's technological advances. There are rising public expectations about care and cure. Health, moreover, is not a fixed goal. It's a standard that rises over time as societies become more affluent, as they become more risk averse, and as they become more secular, that is more likely to see happiness in the here and now as life's ultimate goal.
I think this deals with two things that are really crucial. And don't get enough attention. And you wrote about the case for longer work lives in one of our earlier issue briefs, and this offers some hope that increased health spans will promote that. I hear a lot. I've long been skeptical about the fact that that would result in cost savings.
Yeah.
And what I like about this paper is that it seems to provide some quantitative proof of my off the cuff speculations, but that's really one of but I want to say that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. I mean, I think that the idea of trying to keep people healthier and spending more, however that's defined, is obviously the payoff there is healthier lifespans. And that's what you want.
But there's an individual payoff, right? There's a payoff for individuals, which in and of itself makes it worthwhile. There's a payoff for the economy and indirectly for the budget, if not through healthcare savings, then through higher tax revenue.
Yeah.
So absolutely.
It's all a good thing, and it would help save the talking point that I sometimes hear is, well, if we spent more on prevention, we'd save money, and that's the thing I take it that you're a little bit skeptical about, and that the research doesn't necessarily back up.
Well, it might. But frankly, there isn't a lot of evidence to support that. Look, let me sort of restate all of this more simply. And Chase, this will get back to the question you actually asked me, and allow me to give an answer to that. What has been happening, and it's unambiguously positive, is that the functional health of the elderly has been improving, okay, and rather dramatically so. And the reason for all of my hedging was the deterioration in a whole set of health indicators among midlife adults. So the reason for the hedging was whether this will continue or maybe be reversed. But if it continues, and maybe to ensure it continues, we do need new investments in the health of the elderly, and especially the future elderly, and not just in health, but investments that address all of the underlying social and economic issues and inequalities and disparities that feed in to these adverse health outcomes, right? But if that continues, that will unambiguously help extend work lives, right? That will support that policy agenda. But like you, I'm much more skeptical about the potential for savings, particularly in acute care. Long-term care is a more complicated story.
I do think it's fascinating that you've raised this issue of looking at the people who are 45 rather than the elderly, because, you know, we tend to always just sort of look at, it's a natural thing to do, to just look at what's, if you're looking at 75-year-olds, look at what the trend is in 75-year-olds. But the recent morbidity escalation in the population has really been targeted among younger and not so much the older, which is really probably an underreported thing. So, Chase, it's more you than it is us. Richard and I are fine.
It's all our fault. The boomers blaming the millennials and the Gen Xers.
No. It began with the second half of the boom, which was one long slide on every indicator of social pathology.
All right. Well, we're not on the second
but,
side.
But,
of the
we're right in the middle. But Bob, what you're pointing to, and what I was implicitly pointing to, is sort of the age bracket fallacy, right? Our friend and sometime colleague Neil Howe, right, who's the great guru on generations in American history, once described the difference between age brackets and generations this way. He says an age bracket is a railway station. Think of it as a railway station, right? And you've got a number of these stations along the tracks of life, right? A generation is a train going from station to station, right? The people in the train remain the same, and they bring their baggage with them.
I've got sort of a policy-related question. You mentioned the age bracket fallacy there, Richard, and you talked about how at the, I guess, the latter portion of the baby boom generation and then the up and coming Gen Xers and maybe some millennials were just continuing this slide. You're seeing some negative trends in population health. When you're digging through that data, and the reason why this is a policy question, because it's more about what we should be focusing on moving ahead as policymakers look at these issues. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing a differentiation based on socioeconomic status? Are you seeing lower income individuals who might not have the same resources to live a healthier lifestyle, seeing more negative trends than, say, a higher income individuals who could afford to go and engage in the healthcare system more frequently or afford, you know, healthier diets? Like, what is there a differentiation?
Oh, yeah, well, absolutely. And it's stark and it's dramatic and it's shocking. When you look at the numbers, all of this falls along socioeconomic lines. Life expectancy and health expectancy for the college educated, especially the highly college educated and upper income segment of the population, it continues to rise, and it's stalled for most other groups. Mainly among socioeconomic lines. I'm not sure the disparities by race are widening. They may indeed be narrowing, but these are the so-called deaths of despair. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a huge social problem. When, you know, policy tries to address, you know, aging policy can't be just about aging, right? It has to be about the entire society.
So when you look at these issues, and I don't think your paper went so far as to make specific policy recommendations, but you talked about longer work lives in your previous paper. Now we're talking about healthier lifespans. What areas should be a focus for policymakers? I know we're in the middle of a pandemic, so we're just sort of, I have the long-term in mind on this topic, and I'm sure you do as well. So set aside the current health crisis, and the pandemic as much as you can, because we have to eventually get out of that. But from a long-term perspective, what should policymakers be focusing on in terms of healthcare or retirement security or investments in domestic policy? Like, what do you think are the key areas that we really need to start honing in on?
Well, look, the literature sort of splits two ways on this. There are some studies which suggest that, you know, investments in the health of people who are already elderly can have significant payoffs, okay? But I think there's a larger literature that concludes that the biggest payoffs long-term, that what determines the health of the elderly is investments 60, 70 years before in the health of children. So I think that society needs to focus on that, eliminating disparities. Here, I'm getting off. I'm off the reservation, okay? This is not my area of expertise. We should probably bring in someone from the Urban Institute to talk about this.
But I am curious of your take, because obviously you've got to have thoughts on this as you're looking through this data and policy trends.
I think you have to take a life cycle perspective on this. You know, it's not too late to make improvements in the health of the of today's elderly. It's not too late maybe to arrest and even partially reverse the adverse trends among midlife adults. But you're going to get the biggest payoffs long term by investing in the near end of life. And certainly the federal budget spends a lot more money on the far end of life than it does on the near end. States and localities spend more, but they could certainly spend it more effectively. But again, I hesitate to go beyond these generalizations. This is not my policy bailiwick.
Well, I do think it's important to identify trends so policymakers know what trends are affecting the economy and likely to affect the economy as they think about and develop policies. I mean, if somebody wants to develop a policy based on the fact that it would, you know, save money to do something, to spend more in a certain area, but that it may not for reasons outlined in the paper, that would be an important thing for somebody to know. Or if somebody wanted to, you know, if somebody wanted to make the case for investing more in middle-aged or younger people and their healthcare, or even in children, based on a long-term payoff, that's important to know these things. So, I mean, I don't think you know, I think it's fine to identify trends without necessarily, it's not like there's a solution to the trends. It's you know, identifying a trend, which is important.
Yeah, well, I think the trends are clear, and broad brush, what needs to be done is clear. I was just begging off on the specifics of,
yeah, and I was,
you know,
giving
how
you,
to
I
reform was, Head Start or whatever. That's,
and I was that's I was giving you an excuse for doing.
Thank
so.
You. Thank you.
You drew a distinction before, and you do in the paper, in kind of your hedging on acute care versus long term care.
Yeah,
and you identified another phenomenon, which is that as the, you know, today's elderly tend to have more children supporting them that may be able to help in their later years, whereas tomorrow's elderly may have fewer family members, younger people, children, to be able to take care of them. And this may, you know, increase perhaps pressure for a long-term care spending component, even as you might be saving money in another area. Yeah. So could you just sort of...
Yeah, no, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, look, the impact of improvements in the health of the elderly on acute care spending, it's theoretically ambiguous, right? It's the point I made earlier about, well, does disability lead to falling healthcare spending, or does rising healthcare spending lead to falling disability? Yeah. But it's kind of unambiguous that if disability falls, all other things being equal, there's less demand for long-term care. That seemed right, but all other things won't be equal, and that's the point you were making. Because the demand for long-term care is highly dependent on a whole, you know, raft of socioeconomic factors, and especially the strength of the extended family. mean, a few European countries, in particularly the Nordic countries, have largely socialized the cost of long-term care. Families aren't involved much anymore. You know, if you have Alzheimer's, you know, or otherwise severely disabled and elderly, and in Sweden, you're in a nursing home or some sort of care facility. Here, the family plays a big role. But as you were suggesting, you know, tomorrow's elderly are much more likely to have one child or no child, right? To be never married or divorced or widowed. Even if the propensity of children, right, to care for their aged parents doesn't change, the burden, right? And even if the absolute aggregate demand for long-term care declines, the burden on family caregivers could still rise simply because of the changes in family size and structure. And this is bound to give rise to calls for some sort of long-term care entitlement.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what you just said there, Richard, feeds in rather nicely and presents a lot of the challenges and issues that we're going to see in the economy moving forward. And I think that's why it's all the more pressing for policymakers to be forward-looking on issues like this and issues like long-term investment within the economy, especially coming out of an issue like a health crisis and a pandemic. So I think it's a really timely topic for policymakers to especially take note of. It's always a pleasure having you on the show. This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Richard Jackson, president of the Global Aging Institute, and Bob Bixby discuss the third paper in our Shape of Things to Come series titled Are Health Spans Rising Along with Lifespans? Thanks again for joining the show, Bob and Richard.
Thank you, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Tori Gorman. Tori is the Concord Coalition's policy director, a regular contributor on the show. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Tori.
Hi, Chase, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Happy to have you on the program once again, talking about probably one of the biggest pieces of legislation in a long time. We have what's called the, quote, Corona Bus that worked its way through Congress this week. And it combines a variety of different pieces of legislation. So I'm going to actually kick it over to you to break down for our listeners what is in the Corona Bus and what are some of the implications.
I think that the two main pieces of the Corona Bus, one is the fifth installment of COVID relief aid for individuals, households, and small businesses. The second piece is full year discretionary appropriations funding for the federal government. So we've managed to fund the federal government for the full fiscal year, meaning that the new administration, the Biden administration, can come in January and start the ground running on fiscal 2022 without having to worry about undone homework from the prior Congress. So those were the two major pieces in that bill.
And remind me that those two big pieces, one, the coronavirus relief was around $900 billion. And then the appropriations package was north of $1 trillion, right? Well, where did that number come in at?
Right. So the appropriations package all in, when you include both the regular discretionary plus the cap adjustments that are allowed under law, was about $1.4 trillion. But I did want to point out that, you know, that's money that was included in the baseline all along, right? So I know people are running around saying this is a $2.4 trillion bill. That's not entirely correct. The only new spending above the baseline is the stuff that was added on top of the regular discretionary appropriations. So the COVID relief money, yeah, that's new spending, and the smaller pieces that they added to that, that's all new spending. But the $1.4 trillion for discretionary appropriations, that was included in the baseline. And we always knew that that's what we would have to spend to keep the government operating for the 2021 fiscal year.
Congress was just lagging behind by delaying passing those appropriations. So they just had to throw it all together at the end, right?
Exactly. It's the proverbial kitchen sink, right? There's nothing, the best deadline in town is the Christmas Eve deadline, right? Because members want to get home.
I want to go home. Holiday.
Nobody wants to be stuck in DC after Christmas. And given the fact that this is the end of the 116th Congress as well, we swear in a new Congress in January, there was a concerted push from all fronts that, you know, there's a train moving out of the station. That train has the appropriations bill on it, has the coronavirus legislation on it. then everybody's trying to throw everything else on that train getting out of station. So it's literally a kitchen sink bill. Yeah.
And you wrote a rapid response basically to the Corona bus legislation, outlining the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I want to get to that. But before we do, one more question. You mentioned the train leaving the station. Is the train normally this big and have this many add-ons? Like this, I feel like there's a lot of connections before you get to the caboose. And it just feels like the wrong way to go about legislating.
It really is. And this, I'm a former staffer myself on the Hill. I have friends on the Hill, and there's been a lot of back channeling through emails and stuff like that. And we all believe this is probably the worst example of last minute legislating that we've ever seen, given at least me in my 16 years on the Hill. And part of it is just a function of, in a presidential year, Congress is relatively unproductive anyway. You add in a whole bunch of other factors, the tribalism, the lack of consensus and compromise, and they really just didn't get a lot done this year. So when that last train is leaving the station, it's like your one and only chance to legislate. It just attracts everything. And apparently there was a lot of the process was willing to bear a lot this year, because not only is the bill big in terms of spending, but it's big just in terms of page length. I mean, it's approaching, 5,600 pages. And
which I'm sure all of our leaders read with discipline before they voted, right?
No. And it's funny. I mean, even the subscription services and stuff like that, they get paid to read these bills and digest them and provide summaries for their subscribers, have all said, here's the top line stuff that we've managed to ferret out, but it's going to take us a couple of weeks to go through all of this and figure out what's really truly in it and what details are in it. The Senate Historical Office actually put out a little factoid the other day that's saying this is the largest bill in Senate history that's gone through the chamber. That before the Corona bus bill passed the Senate, the record was held by the 1986 tax reform bill, which was basically half the size of the one that just passed.
Wow. And in your blog, you basically said legislators will hold their nose and vote for this because it's effectively a must pass piece of legislation. So let's break it down a little bit, starting with the good. So what was the good you highlighted in the coronavirus?
Right out of the gate, two pieces of good information that come out of this bill. One, COVID relief is finally on the way. We've known for a while now, both looking at economic statistics, particularly the job market, but also from health statistics and this second wave of coronavirus cases. The U.S. economy has been in need of COVID relief for quite some time. We passed four quick bills earlier this spring, and then Congress spent 8 months arguing on what to do next. In the meantime, 17 million Americans caught COVID and hundreds of thousands of more died. I think it's also really good news that the government is funded for the next fiscal year. I can't imagine the headache a new administration would have in trying to stand up a new government while at the same time trying to complete work on appropriations that should have been done by the previous Congress.
Are there pieces of the good that you wish more good would have been added to it? So like, for instance, we talked about how big this COVID relief packages, but were there pieces excluded that maybe once were on the table could have been beneficial but weren't included this time around?
Concord Coalition has always taken the position that coronavirus relief should be what we call the 3T test: timely, targeted, and temporary. And I think there are some provisions in the bill that definitely follow that, but I think there are some provisions in there that probably weren't a good use of money. The case in point, there's money in there for another round of rebate checks, $600 per person rebate checks. That's not essentially targeted. There's no sort of demonstration of need in qualifying for those checks. And I would have liked to have seen that money spent, for example, on unemployment insurance. If you look at the provisions that are in the bill, it's not a very long duration piece of legislation. So the unemployment insurance is good for about 10 weeks. The small business aid probably covers, the Paycheck Protection Program provides about 3 months worth of assistance to small businesses. I think it's pretty apparent that we're going to be dealing with a sluggish economy and galloping coronavirus cases for beyond the next 3 months. So it would have been nice to have seen a package that spent more on more targeted relief programs for a longer period of time. But it is what it is, and I'm glad that we've got it, rather than going into the Christmas holidays and a potentially another bump in coronavirus cases without this aid on the way.
And Tori, you mentioned the checks to individuals and dependents. I'm wondering that that might be lending itself more towards the bad in the bill. So what are some of the items that you highlighted as potentially bad items in the coronavirus?
I talked a little bit about how, you know, we at the Concord Coalition, we look for provisions that follow the three T's: timely, targeted, and temporary. And obviously we talked about how the rebate checks don't necessarily fall into that category. But there are things like there was a resurrection of the business meal deduction that was actually axed in the 2017 tax reform bill. Eliminating that tax deduction was one of the pay-fors in the 2017 Tax Reform Act. I just don't think that's very targeted. I think there are different ways to help small business. I know people, you can make the argument, oh, we're helping restaurants. That's not what restaurants need, especially given the number of closures that are associated with coronavirus cases. It doesn't matter if business lunches or business dinners are tax deductible if the restaurant can't open to provide or to serve their customers. So, I mean, I could go on, but there are definitely things that were not targeted to those who are really in need. There were some things that were included in the bill that are just extraneous. They had nothing to do with coronavirus relief, and they had nothing to do with funding the government for the next year. Tax extenders, you know, sort of niche tax items that Congress rolls over, you know, every 1 or 2 years. I call that the Lobbyist Full Employment Act. But there is like a water resources bill in there. There's some things on energy provisions. There's just a host of unrelated stuff that I just don't think belongs in there. And I think the last thing that was sort of disappointing about this is that there are two sticky issues that were not resolved in this legislation. One was sort of direct aid to state and local governments, and limited liability for employers. You know, those are the two issues that the Republicans and Democrats could not come to agreement on. And so the decision was to just jettison them. I think the reason they had to do that is that they started negotiations way too late. I think if they had been discussing this in earnest throughout the summer, they could have come to an agreement on those issues. And let's be frank, those issues are not going away. Just because we're not dealing with them now doesn't mean that we can ignore them forever. So they remain issues. They will be matters that the next Congress has to contend with. Those are the things that are not so attractive.
Yeah. And it sounds like some of those quote bad things in this legislation maybe aren't inherently bad, but are worthy of discussion and debate on their own merits versus just throwing it into a must pass bill like this.
Exactly. I agree 100%.
All right. So last question before we close out this segment, Tori, the ugly. What really stood out to you as almost abhorrent in the coronavirus, or maybe it had more to do with the process or how legislators went about this, but what stood out to you as the ugly?
I guess it depends on which hat I wear. So if I wear my hat as an American, I think the thing that was just absolutely ugly about this was the legislative process. Again, Congress doesn't accomplish much in a presidential election year, but when the backdrop is a viral pandemic that is killing thousands of Americans every day, I think a sense of urgency should prevail. You know, the months-long bickering and foot dragging while our countrymen and women suffered, I think was a horrible dereliction of duty by the United States Congress. And if it wasn't for a courageous group, a small group of senators and members of the House that were willing to challenge their respective leaders and bypass the committee process, we wouldn't have legislation today. And I think that's just horrible. If I take my patriotic American hat off and put my budget bean counter hat on, I think what's really, really ugly about this is once we get done lifting up the hood on this piece of legislation and actually going through it line by line and looking at how organizations like the Congressional Budget Office score this piece of legislation, we're going to find a boatload of budget gimmicks in here and backdoor spending devices, directed scorekeeping, all of these things that allowed Congress to spend more than they were allowed to by law in the case of discretionary appropriations, or in ways that help hide the cost of the overall legislation. And then the problem with that, aside from just fibbing about the cost of the legislation, is that it teaches the next Congress how to do these things, right? It seems like each time these bill drafters get more wily and more crafty with how to hide the costs of legislation. And then the next Congress just takes that and runs with it and expands that even more in terms of thinking long-term and how to adopt fiscal discipline. You start to see how hard it is to rein in a Congress. If a Congress wants to spend, it's gonna spend no matter what we try to do. So unless and until voters start holding their members of Congress, their feet to the fire, and start demanding change when it comes to, you know, reducing our budget deficits, reducing the amount of debt that we're accumulating. This kind of behavior is just going to keep happening.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to me and Tory Gorman discuss the good, the bad, and the ugly in the massive coronavirus legislation covering COVID-19 relief, fiscal year 21 appropriations, and much more. Thanks for joining the show, Tory.
Thanks, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.